Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello, I'm Janet Thompson, and this is 3CR Community Radio on 855 on your dial. And this is Radical Philosophy. That's philosophy for everyone.
So glad you tuned in to Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Laura Jocic about the role of dress in colonial Australian society. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a really interesting topic. I'm so glad you could make it. So, and this is part two of a two-part interview. I think young girls, if they were fortunate enough to go to school, they used to do what was called a sampler, and they'd put that on the wall. And, so what's the history behind that?
Oh, samplers are, centuries old, and this was a way of education and instruction for young girls. There's been really fantastic work done on samplers. And when we're talking about samplers, we're not just talking about often what we think about of the alphabet. That was a way to learn the alphabet too, to stitch it into samplers. But also what they call plain needlework samplers, where they made miniature buttonholes and miniature shirts, for instance, and dresses or undergarments, and learned how to hem. And actually, I had published a freely available article online through Museums Victoria in their new journal called Prism, and I did research on a sampler from 1840 with, again, a very good provenance to Ireland, and an Irish immigrant girl who came to the Port Phillip district in 1844. And that's called Anne Trotter's Needlework Sample Book, 1840. And the modes of instruction of needlework being a gendered subject that was taught only to girls in schools, and particularly to working class girls, for not only being able to make own clothes in the home and in the future for their families, but actually as a form of employment, because we think about domestic servants and what they were doing in the home. As I said, prior to the sewing machine, they were doing a lot of this plain needlework of mending, hemming, making table linen, for instance, hemming table linen. And so this was a really important skill to have as employment.
Yeah, it really would have been. So, could you give a description of Anna King's dress?
Yes, well, I mentioned sort of neoclassical style. So the high waist, it's a white muslin with gilded, sprigged, as you say, metallic embroidery. An easy way probably that people could understand it, it's Jane Austen era, and we find that neoclassical style, particularly attractive, I think, and a lighter, we might like to say, more suitable type of dress for the climate and the Australian colonies. But it was a ball gown sort of dress. It's slightly shorter. It's not to the floor. It would have been suitable for dancing. And it would have been the type of gown that she wore as the wife of the governor, at hosting dinners at Government House. And also every year there was the King's birthday ball. At this point, we're talking early 19th century. That was a big celebration that happened at Government House. So that would be the type of dress that she wore and she knew that she needed.
Yeah, and then when I saw a photo, I thought, wow, that's quite stunning. Mm-hmm. What was the research methodology that was used to study the role of dress?
Mm. Well, my approach in my thesis, and there are a number of ways you can actually approach, of course, garments and their research. Having come from a curatorial background and worked with collections, and I had worked for 6 years at the National Gallery of Victoria in the what was then the Australian Fashion and Textiles Collection as a curator. And in 2010, I curated an exhibition called Australian Made, 100 Years of Fashion. It was 1850s to 1950s. And taking that object-based, collection-based focus to work with the collection to draw out a 100-year range of garments in the collection and to start, you know, doing some deep research on them. I found that a very fruitful approach, that if you worked with provenance or, you know, the garment itself and how it was made and the type of fabrics, for instance, that it was made from, as a way to really get a more fine-grained understanding about dress in a settler colonial Australian society. And you can be taken in some surprising directions. So my methodology for the thesis was not only to work from the objects themselves, but a bit of a rod for my back in a way was I had to have actually seen every garment and where it was absolutely possible, which really was in most cases, to look at it flat on a table and to be able to look inside and look at the stitching as well. So a very focused, if you like, sort of a bit of a production focus as well, as to how is this garment actually made. And from that, starting to deduce, things that pop up that look very familiar. So the more you see, you become conversant with what is familiar and what might be unusual. The material culture methodology is something that's been there in a number of disciplines for many years, and the art historian Jules Proun has been very influential in devising this methodology in the early 1980s to use objects as the basis for historical inquiry. So I was very keen not to have garments and clothing just as add-ons to support what is being said historically, but to start with the garments themselves and interrogate about what we know, and it might raise questions or change how we understand things. So Proun talked about a methodology, a three-step methodology of inquiry, which would involve description first, looking very closely at the object and noting aspects of the object, how it's made, what it's made from, for instance. Deduction, what does this object sort of, for instance, what's the weight of this fabric? What may it have been like to wear? And then speculation, which is really going into the historic research and contextual aspect. And that approach has been very influential on dress and object-based dress history.
So I think most people know what Sovereign Hill is, and it's sort of like a reproduction of a colonial society. And you've got all the houses, and they've set them up like the blacksmiths, and even like a little funeral house there as well, and the lolly shop, of course, and then there's the clothes shop. And when you're up there, what you can do is you can actually go and get dressed up in the costumes and have your photos taken. So I went up there with my partner, and it was a really hot day. And we thought for a bit of fun we'd have our photos taken. So they got out a couple of dresses and long sleeve dresses that were, I mean, there were a couple of layers. You could tell there was the petticoat underneath. So we got dressed up in this and had our photos taken. And, oh, my God, I thought I was going to pass out with the heat. And I thought, geez, couldn't wait to get back into, you know, and take it off and just have shorts and T-shirt on. And then it struck me. I thought, geez, it's so hot up here. And basically people would have had to just wear one of these really hot dresses all day, wouldn't they, especially for modesty.
Yes, yeah. This idea about whether, you know, British European style clothing was suitable for the climate, and particularly how did women survive and do the work that they did. Because women were very much there on the goldfields and in rural areas, working on the properties, working on the goldfields. There's some wonderful images by artists on the goldfields, like Strutt and Eugene von Gerard, little vignettes of women working on the goldfields, chopping wood. And their dress is very interesting because they are wearing the full skirts and they are wearing the long-sleeved dresses. So that's a big question. I think it's relative too. We have to think about what comfort and practicality did mean to women in those days. And another thing that comes up is their corsets. And again, we have to rethink corsets, and there's been good work being done in this area too, because we need to think about corsets as foundation undergarments, because the bra didn't exist. The corset was an important undergarment. We also have to think that corsets, the way they're constructed is you can loosen them off. They're laced. And in looking for, you know, those gems in letters when I went to the archives and searching through and diving into Acacia letters, thinking, okay, the high-level information here is that they're letters written by a woman on the goldfields at this particular period. And you think, is she writing about her dress? Is please, please. And, you know, you spend a lot of time reading about their circumstances and their lives, and then you find the gems where some women have actually said what they're doing with their dress in these environments. And they're saying, it's really hot here, so I'm going about without my petticoats and without my stockings. So they're, you know, just the practical aspect of, like all people, regulating their dress. I would also say that they wouldn't have appeared in a more formal situation like that. They were probably about the house, about their tent, if they were living on in a tent on the gold fields. And other women would have been doing the same. But if they had to go into town for something more formal, the petticoats and stockings would have been back on. But they are saying this. And, you know, they're saying it's hot and this is what I'm doing. And so that's, you know, women often in their letters and people writing letters, often these letters were to their family back home, largely Britain. And so they're not talking about ordinary things. They're talking about what's distinctive, what's different. And that crops up in the letters. So that's when you get the, well, I'm not actually wearing my petticoats. Yeah. So
it's the same sort of thing with Christmas dinner, because it's been traditional that you have a hot Christmas dinner. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a really hot day, Christmas Day here in Australia. So it's like, can't we just have a salad? You know, it's all this hot food. Yeah.
I will add just to say too about, you know, this wonderful, that was Jane Foreman on the goldfields describing what she was doing with her dress. Another great source of information is Rachel Henning and her published journals. And I particularly looked at the period of 1862 to 1865 when she went to live on her brother's property called Exmoor in Queensland. was quite remote. As it turned out, she was there for 3 years and she did not get to town at all and buy new dresses during that time. She knew what she was going to, and she prepared herself well in Sydney for the types of garments that she would need, dresses. And there's this aspect here about class again, and a genteel woman maintaining standards in an environment like that. And she talks about the practical sort of dresses that she was equipping herself with to go away for so long that she wouldn't be able to purchase anymore. And so she talks about, for instance, interestingly, a black dress being a really good type of dress that was practical to be worn in that environment. And certainly, I think, for visiting and things like that, where it was a subdued type of not showy garment and it had a number of uses. And that also then raises the question about black only being for mourning. And it crops up at this era and earlier that women wearing black, it wasn't always for mourning. It was a suitable sort of dress to be wearing that was understated and appropriate for a genteel woman to be wearing. She talks about her brother maintaining standards within the house and certainly sitting in the drawing room, and no men were to be in there without a jacket. And she said that Biddulph, her brother, had a horror of people being shabby. That's a great word. And again, you know, this class aspect of expectations and protocols.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I imagine most women would have had a black dress for funerals.
Yes, useful for that too. It's in the wardrobe standard.
Yeah, because there were quite a few.
Observing mourning, which usually fell, the burden fell to women to observe mourning for longer.
That's right. So could you explain about the process of historical interpretation of clothing?
I did explain a bit about the approach I've taken, which is the material culture approach, object-centred inquiry. There are other really interesting areas. There's a theoretical approach to dress and fashion. And then there's a really interesting thing happening in more recent years called the making turn. And this is a form of historical inquiry where historical garments are being reconstructed. And it's a methodology that encompasses the idea of, you know, how long it takes to make a garment, hand-stitching a garment, and then the ability to actually wear that reproduction and get a sense of, for instance, what a corset might be like. And it's often, it comes from the archaeological methodology of what's called experimental sort of methodology, where you actually reconstruct something, for instance, rebuild a dry stone wall, something like that, and document that. A colleague of mine, Sarah Bendall, has been doing very interesting work in this area with 17th century corsets, which weren't called corsets then, they were called bodies. And she's been reconstructing these from going to original items in British collections, and then has been feeding that into her research about the significance of foundation garments, and as she calls her book, Shaping Femininity in the 17th Century Britain. So I think that's a really interesting development in the field of dress and fashion history and what we can gain from that. And so it is a particularly vibrant area, I think, of dress research has really been exploding in the last 30 years.
Yeah, it has. You often see, like at the Arts Centre, they'll have some sort of display on dresses and costumes and things. So what are some of the other ways of thinking about the significance of women's dress?
Yeah, you know, there is the aspect of gender and what the importance of dress meant to women. There's the production side of the making, the hidden women who are making these garments. Often there was an outcry in the 19th century about exploitation of the poor seamstress who was underpaid and had terrible working conditions. That is an area that's, you know, garnered sort of academic research, and there's plenty more to be done there. The aspect of gender and class and identity and clothing. There's the creative aspect. And if we think more, you know, I've been talking historically, but, you know, in contemporary fashion and fashion research, about this area as being a site for identity and defining oneself, and a really creative site where one can play with fashion and be creative and change identity. And we've seen that, you know, particularly I'm thinking of, you know, 1980s club culture, the fusion of art, fashion, music, film that went on. That's, yeah, really interesting area to reflect on.
Yeah, it is. So is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't already covered?
I think it probably goes without saying that the study of dress and fashion and textiles is not a frivolous area. It is an area that has great weight, because when you think about it, dress is just a part of our lives. And also it's extremely important, and, you know, it has been for centuries. Whole economies are built on production of textiles, for instance, and technology, development of technology comes into it. So it's a wonderful interdisciplinary area to be working in. We think about, for instance, invention of the spinning jenny, 18th century and early 19th century mechanisation of weaving that created an incredible amount of wealth out of particularly Britain, and the mechanisation of cotton spinning, and then more affordable, cheaper textiles being able to be exported to the world. Within that, of course, with the cotton industry, more work is being done about its links to the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, and what that means, and the types of restorative justice that have been looked at there as well.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me. I mean, people say, oh, you know, working in a sweatshop, you know, with these industrial sewing machines. And, well, these days, I think they, instead of hiding people down the back, you actually go somewhere to have your pants taken up and someone's there in the window with the sewing machine. So, I mean, I don't know if things have really changed. Maybe they're getting... It's interesting, isn't it? It's like they're there on display. It's sort of almost like whoever has the company, like, oh, I have nothing to hide. They're there and they're happy. But are they really? I mean, with the working hours and whatnot, it's something you always need, isn't it? Even if you don't have tailored clothes made, you're going to need your pants taken up or your shirt taken up or something. So it's sort of an ongoing sort of business, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that's a really good point about what is on display in the production of clothing and what is hidden, and that's the whole huge area about the conditions of garment workers overseas and in types and checks and balances that, you know, as consumers we can make choices about what's required and what companies need to be putting in place about this. Yeah. So
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's been great having you on the program today.
Thanks for coming. Thank you very much. As you can see, there's a lot. I can go down many rabbit holes about areas of, you know, particularly fashion and textiles within the Australian colonial context.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Laura Jocic about the role of dress in colonial Australian society. Great to have your company, and do tune in next month.